We now begin a whole new Masechta. This is the introduction to Maseches Sanhedrin. And it's going to be longer than the typical introduction because there really is a lot to say here. The word Sanhedrin, the name of the Masechta, is a Greek word. It means like a convocation of elders, you know, a get-together of wise men. It's a Greek word, which of course now is applied to typically to the Jewish Supreme Court, that great Sanhedrin of 71 men who sat in the Chamber of Hewn Stone, the Lishkas HaGazis. But the Masechta, certainly when you consider it in the context of with its sister Masechta, Maseches Makos, and they really should be considered together because there's very good reason to believe that originally Sanhedrin and Makos were one larger Masechta. So the Masechta Sanhedrin comes to explain the Jewish court system, how the courts work, how they are constituted, the different kinds of courts, how they entertain evidence, how they do the various procedures in terms of carrying out, enforcing their rulings, punishments, and the like. So that is the scope in the largest sense of our Masechta. Now just the place of it in like the larger Jewish worldview. Really, the Jewish people are comprised of a bunch of individuals. And as an individual, the primary way in which you're meant to relate to your fellow Jew is ahava, is love. The mitzvah is ve'ahavta l'recha kamocha. Every Jew is expected to love his fellow Jew as he loves himself, meaning that you are meant to want the best for your fellow Jew as you want for yourself. What you'd want for yourself, you want for the other. And therefore, in the event you have conflict with another Jew, the posture should be one of consideration. And really, like to every, ideally, every interaction between Jew and fellow Jew should be motivated by chesed to do right and good and benefit the other. So that is the ideal. And therefore, the goal is whenever there's conflict, so we are seeking the supreme Jewish value of all, which is shalom. At least in this world, the supreme value of the Torah, even ahead of emes and ahead of truth, is shalom, is peace. And in truth, the word shalom is a peace, a poor translation. Really, it means more like harmony. From like a Lashon Shlemus, completion, the coherent and harmonious interaction of multiple parts. So you have different people interacting well together without conflict, or more than without conflict. They're actually able to build a society together, which is greater than any of those individual people. So that's the ideal. We have conflict, we want shalom, and people should be able to work it out. And therefore, even when there is conflict, and we need to have recourse to a third party because two people can't agree amongst themselves, the ideal would be for some kind of pshara, some kind of compromise, rather than actually enforcing the law, the hard, cold letter of the law. We want a pshara, some kind of compromise where everyone walks away to whatever degree they can, as much as possible, happy, satisfied, so that shalom, peaceful relations, harmony can continue. But of course, sometimes it's not possible. Sometimes we need to resolve conflicts in a way that really there's no middle ground, or the two parties can't be reconciled with some kind of agreement in the middle. And at that point, we need to have recourse to a legal system. Now, the court system, the legal system, therefore, is critical because without it, without a faith in it, a trust in it, and an ability for it to rule fairly and enforce what it rules, people would turn to, you know, essentially violence, conflict, or resolution. And then, of course, that undermines the entire spirit of the Torah, where you have might as opposed to justice arbitrating, you know, conflict. That's terrible. And therefore, there's an institution of court systems, which essentially is there to enforce mishpat. Mishpat means law, law and order, the rules. And the people who enforce mishpat are called shoftim, from the same shoresh. And the idea being that if you can't agree on some with goodwill and love and some common ground and compromise, so then there's a clear set of rules that govern essentially every interaction. The Torah is Torah Shem Tamim, that's complete, and it should be able to apply to at least tell people what is the strict letter of the law, and the courts can enforce that, if nothing else. So the system, therefore, is by individuals, ideally, an Avos Chesed approach, seeking shalom. Failing that, you have a third party who would then do pshara, compromise, again, achieve shalom. If you can't do that, you're turning to mishpat, strict enforcement of the letter of the law. And that two-pronged system of shalom, if you can, and if you can't, at least mishpat, together yield a system which is considered to be tzedek, to be just. Okay, and that is like the supreme yardstick of social interaction, at least that a society should be just, and its rules should be just, and that's Tzedek would include both of those levels, the private personal relationship shooting for shalom, and if not that, then at least a strict letter of the law. Now, when we need to get to institutional enforcement of, you know, for conflict resolution, like a court system, so then we have essentially one pasuk which mandates one mitzvah. The pasuk is the beginning of Parsis Shoftim, it's a famous pasuk. Shoftim v'shotrim titan lacha b'chol sha'arecha. You will establish and place shoftim, those are the people who will essentially apply and interpret the law, mishpat, those are shoftim, and then shoter, someone who enforces that application of the law. It could be that the shoftim nowadays have both of those abilities, to interpret slash apply, and then also to enforce what they interpret and apply. And that's essential that it can be enforced, of course, so it's meaningful. Rule of law is essential for any functioning society to operate well, economy and the like. So, b'chol sha'arecha, says the pasuk, it should be established in all of your gates. That would be understood to be like every city. Every city of a given size has to have its a court system that operates. And then also, asher Hashem lokecha nosan lecha l'shivatecha, that Hashem gave you to each of the shvatim, each of the tribes, is also not just city courts, is also going to be understood to be like a shevet wide, kind of like a county, right? Like the shevet, the 12 shvatim, the 12 tribes, each will have their own like regional court, larger court of 23, and then that's in addition to another court, the Great Sanhedrin. And the pasuk ends by saying v'shaftu es ha'am, and those shoftim v'shotrim, those shoftim, the judges who are enforcing mishpat, they'll be shaftu es ha'am, they'll judge the nation mishpat tzedek, with a law that's tzedek, that's righteous. So that means they were applying mishpat, that strict letter of the law, and that's kind of formulaic, of course. It's like what the rule books say, how they're interpreted regardless of who the litigants are. But it should be a mishpat of tzedek. Now, so tzedek in this context, of course, it can't be that we're sort of softening the din, softening judgment or justice. It has to be, and we can't sort of take into consideration who the litigants are, and oh, he's a poor person, or he's a person who has struggles. No, once you're gone to mishpat, it has to be strict letter of the law. But you still can have a mishpat tzedek, a righteous law, which means that at least it can be applied in a humane way, in a sensitive way, in a way that, you know, doesn't let lets the participants in the legal system at least feel, I'll call it emotionally, psychologically, that they got justice, they got a fair shake, that they were heard out, and that the justices, you know, tried the case in a way that was fair and legitimate and considerate and humane. So that's one mitzvah, one pasuk, that's one mitzvah in the Torah to establish a court system, and that's really sort of the centerpiece of our mesechta. Now, the courts actually come in three varieties, basic varieties, and that the differences are the number of dayanim, of the shoftim, of judges, who sit on that bezdin, on that court. So you can have a bezdin of three, meaning three judges, a bezdin of 23, or a bezdin of 71 judges, okay? Now, a court of three judges is the most basic, and that really is typically to decide on basic torts, interpersonal complaints, you know, loans, damages, theft, sales, and stuff like that. So the truth is that to function as a judge on a bezin of three, so then essentially anybody can do that as long as they are agreeable to the litigants. Nothing more than that is required. A bezin of three can also adjudicate on knasot, on the penalties that the Torah imposed on people, meaning, for example, so a knas, a penalty, is anytime you're not talking about just sort of financial restitution, making someone whole from some sort of damage or loss that they incurred, but you're actually sort of penalizing them. So, for example, even like the tashlumi kefil, when one steals something, he has to pay back double what he stole. So the returning what he stole would be, of course, a basic monetary return, mamon, just a basic return of the money that was taken. But there's also the kanas, there's a penalty of a second, like a double payment. So the kanas, the kefil, or if you have, for example, someone steals a cow or a goat and then he shechts it or he sells it, the thief does, so then there's like this other, there's this arba of chamisha that could be a penalty of four or five times. Those are knasot. And there are other knasot in the Torah, the penalties, like, for example, the onus and the mafata and the moti shemra. So in these cases, you could have a bezin of three doing a kanas, but those dayanim then can't be just any dayan. It has to be someone who has smicha, who's a musmach. Now, the notion of smicha is Originally, Moshe Rabbeinu himself was somech, he like lay his hands onto Yahushua ben Nun, his Talmud, and essentially conferred upon him not just the authority, well, basically the authority to carry on in his position and to judge the people. The laying of the hands isn't essential, but this passing on of the full transmission of the Torah and authorizing another person from one judge, authorizing another judge to judge in a case, whether it's there are different kinds of authorizations, the Yora Yora and the Yadin Yadin, etc. So that was a transmission that was not broken from Moshe Rabbeinu until around roughly the year 400. Okay, in the year roughly 400, the Sanhedrin stopped functioning in Eretz Yisrael in a normal way. And since Smicha can only be conferred in Eretz Yisrael, so this tradition of Smicha stopped. The Jewish people, essentially, their core of the Jewish people and the leadership, the rabbinic leadership, left Eretz Yisrael and transitioned over to Bavel in that 3rd century, 3rd, 4th century, and therefore it stops altogether, the notion of smicha. So we have what we call today, smicha is really like a tradition, but it's smicha light. It's not the smicha that you have of like a tradition back to Moshe Rabbeinu of getting the Masorah. No, it's just that one rabbi or judge essentially gives an authorization to another person to act as a rabbi or judge, and it's smicha light. It doesn't really have the weight of before, and doesn't certainly carry the weight of the obligation, that doesn't satisfy the obligation to be a musmach, to have smicha, to adjudicate like a knas. So that therefore, we just don't judge knasot cases anymore at all. Fine. So those are the Bate Din of 3. Then you have a Bez Din of 23. So the Bez Din of 23 is primarily there to judge capital cases, when there's a potential someone who could be executed for their crime. So then you need a Bezin of 23 for that. Again, they need to be musmachim. We don't have that today, so doesn't apply nowadays at all. And then you have the one that would exist, those 23 would exist, Bezin of 23 would exist like in every Shevet, you'd have these Bate Din. But then you'd also have one Jewish Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin HaGadol, the Great Sanhedrin, which would sit in the Lishkas HaGazis, in the Chamber of Hewn Stone, on the Har HaBayis there, as part of the, basically the Beis HaMikdash complex. So the lesser Bate Din of 3 are just called the Bezdin. The greater of 23 and 71 are both called Sanhedrins, but you could have a Sanhedri Katana, a lesser Sanhedrin, that's anyone of 23, and there are multiple of those across Eretz Yisrael, at least in the Torah, as it's setting out the system. Whereas the Sanhedrin HaGadol is, there's only one, okay, and that's a 71 person Sanhedrin in Yerushalayim there on the, as part of the Beis HaMikdash complex. Now the Sanhedrin HaGadol adjudicates special cases that essentially that apply to the nation as a whole. So sometimes you could have capital cases which are bigger than just a simple person killing someone else. For example, if you have like a Yerni Dachas, like a wayward city, or you have like a false prophet, also might have to deal with things like a Kohen Gadol and the like. So these kind of cases would require the Sanhedrin Gadol, but the Sanhedrin Gadol also does national issues, like for example, setting the Jewish calendar, do we make this a leap year? When would we declare a new moon? And other things as well, like the boundaries of Eretz Yisrael and of Yerushalayim, and dealing with other sort of national concerns, going to war and the like. So that is the role of the Sanhedrin HaGadol. And so long as it is set up in the Lishkas HaGazis and operating there, so then the Sanhedrin Katanos, the lesser Sanhedrins of 23, can judge capital cases. If they're not sitting in the Lishkas HaGazis, so then those 23-person Sanhedrins cannot judge capital cases either. And the Gemara actually says that 40 years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, so roughly the year 30 of the Common Era, the Sanhedrin HaGadol intentionally left the Lishkas HaGazis so that they could no longer try capital cases around the country because there were just too many murderers and murders happening. Okay, so in addition to the one mitzvah of establishing courts, there are two other important mitzvahs which would apply specifically to the Sanhedrin HaGadol. The Sanhedrin HaGadol makes a decision, and the decisions there are also made by a majority, as all the every decision that's rendered by the court system, it's always Acher Rabban Lahatos, we go for the majority. So of the 71, if for argument's sake, 30 say Mutter and 41 say Usser, whatever it is, so then the majority is the ruling. If there's an obligation on every individual Jew to conform to the rulings of the Sanhedrin Haggadol. Okay? It's a law that says lo sasur, you cannot deviate from the rulings of the Sanhedrin, and they're binding on us. So when one violates an Isser derabanan, or doesn't do a mitzvah derabanan, that was rendered affected by the Sanhedrin or the equivalent, so then they're over an Isser deraisa of lo sasur. Okay, this would be the reason, simple explanation for when you say, when we do mitzvahs derabanan, like washing our hands before eating bread, or lighting the Hanukkah candles, or reading the Megillah on Purim and the like, we say Asher Kedishan b'mitzvosa v'tzivano. We say Hashem sanctified us and commanded us to, you know, light the Hanukkah lights. So now, where in the world did Hashem command us that it's a rabbinic enactment to light Hanukkah lights? The answer is, well, Hashem said, listen to the Sanhedrin, and the Sanhedrin said we should do it. So that is what's going on. That's the simple understanding of the mitzvah that you're doing there. So every time a person is over a mitzvah derabanan, he's actually over a mitzvah deraisa also, if you will, of lo sasur. And that's specifically to the Sanhedrin Gadol. There's a separate mitzvah in the Torah, which applies not to you or me, but it would apply to a zakin. If you have a sage in Israel who is what's called a zakin mamre, he's a rebellious elder. That means that he is aware of the Sanhedrin's ruling, and he rules contrary to the Sanhedrin. In other words, he knows that Sanhedrin said something is forbidden to do, but he continues to teach other people that it's permitted. We're not talking about someone who, in his private self, you know, behind closed doors, whatever it is, in his home, he does contrary to the Sanhedrin. That would be a lo sasur issue. But once he's teaching, once an elder who's a dynam in his own right, who's teaching others, rendering rulings that are in contravening what the Sanhedrin Haggadol had ruled, he is called a Zaken Mamre, a rebellious elder, and that also carries a death penalty. So that's a separate mitzvah from the Torah as well. Okay, so now, nowadays we don't have any of that really. We just have the Bat Din of three, and they're basically just for, like we said before, basically for, in terms of litigation, it's for, you know, just for mamonos financial claims and disputes. If, for whatever reason, nowadays, you have two Jews that are fighting with each other, and they're required to go to a Jewish bezdin and not to a secular court called arkaos. Secular courts are called arkaos, and there's an issue to go to arkaos in the event that a person, like someone's Reuven sues Shimon, and Shimon essentially refused to go to bezdin, doesn't care about bezdin. So Reuven would be allowed, with the permission of a bezdin, to take Shimon to secular court. That's his last option, but it must be done only with the approval of the Bezdin. Otherwise, it's an Israel to itself. Okay? Those are called our kos. Now, who can be chosen as a Dayan? So, the Rambam basically enumerates seven essential midos that apply to anybody who should be chosen as a Dayan. He has to be a Chacham. He has to be wise. He has to have Yira, meaning he has to have Yira Shemaim. He has to be God-fearing. He has to have a nava, he has to be a humble person. He has to have sinas mamon. That means literally means hate money. But the point is that he cannot be someone who is overly zealous for getting rich. Okay, this is, of course, because that would make him prone to bribery and the like. He has to have avas ha'emes. He has to love truth, meaning he has to really care that justice is done and right thing is carried out. Essential to him. He has to be Oves Abrios. He has to love his fellow Jew, love people, love humanity. He has to be someone who's not a grump and a grinch. And finally, he has to be a Baal Shem Tov. He has to be someone who has a good reputation. Okay, those seven things are required, and that's required for a dayan, even on a bezdin of three. That's what you're looking for. If someone is sitting on a larger Sanhedrin of 23 or 71, so then he has to be, in addition, he has to be like a they have to be someone who is like a real outstanding, clear, towering Talmud Chacham, and he has to be Bali Dea Maruba. He has to really be also educated in the larger sense. He has to have expertise beyond the realm of Torah. Exactly what's included in that, the wrong one to mind, is it's a discussion, but we're talking about, you know, understanding how the world works in general, in terms of also mathematics, sciences, and the like. There is a requirement that every dayan should be born a Jew, meaning that his mother is Jewish. A ger, who in normal circumstances, a convert, is treated like a Jew in all sense. They are a Jew in every sense. But for whatever reasons, gzeiras hakasuv, a ger may not function as a dayan. And same goes for a woman. A woman may not function as a dayan either. that was puzzled to be Diana. And finally, anyone who's puzzled to be an aide in general, we'll discuss that more at length in a moment, but someone who can't testify, let's say, for example, a relative, if the judge, the dying, is a relative of another one of the judges or the witnesses or one of the plaintiffs, the litigants, so then he'd be a karov, a relative who was not allowed to participate in functioning as a judge in such a case. Fine. So now, that's who you choose to be your judge and who can't be chosen. Now, let's talk about the other important piece of the puzzle, which is edus. So now, edus means testimony, and the primary way, the primary source of evidence in the Torah system by which judges will make their decisions is on the testimony of edim, edi re'ia, firsthand, I'll call them eyewitnesses, okay? Now, typically, we need to have two of them to establish a halachic fact. The pasuk, the famous pasuk, is al pi shnei edim o al pi shlosha edim yakum davar. On the basis, the testimony of two witnesses or of three witnesses, the matter is established. I mean, so to speak, the Beis Din almost like recreates vicariously the halachic event, if you will, in a conceptual sense, in the Beis Din through the testimony of these witnesses. Okay, it says two or three because there's no difference. Once you have two, that's considered to be sort of like halachically incontrovertible. Two witnesses are all you need to establish halachic fact. And since that's all you need, there's no advantage really to having three or four or 100 witnesses. Once you have two, that's all you need. Two isn't really better or worse than 100. Okay. The witnesses themselves, in general, you need to have two of them, and they both have to have testimony that corroborates with one another. There are occasions where one witness will be, so to speak, better than nothing. So the basic place there is that if you have just one witness supporting your case, and let's say you're claiming someone owes you money, so then while that won't be enough to extract the money, because to extract you need to have a convincing evidence that requires two witnesses, but at least you can then force the defendant to make a shvua doraisa. You have people forced to swear, taking an oath by the court on a doraisa level to repudiate the claim that is supported by one witness. Okay, there are other times where a single witness, besides for that, where you just need one witness, and actually when you don't need formal edus per se, but you need to sort of just clarify the facts of what has happened. Okay, so the most famous example of that is any what's called aid echad, one witness is ne'eman b'isurin, is believed when it comes to matters of prohibition. So, for example, you want to know, is this meat kosher? Did it come from the kosher butchery or not? So you just need the facts. So then one person can tell you the facts. I saw that it came from the kosher butchery or came from the trade butchery and the like. Okay? And that, once you need just one aid to establish these, you know, isurin matters, so then the aid can be also a woman. So when the rules for aidim, we need to have formal aidus in a Beis Din, so then you cannot have a woman, and you cannot have relatives either. This is because they are sakasav, even two people, two brothers, you know, it's Moshe and Aaron themselves, they can't be the two witnesses. That's a gezeirah sakasav. You also can't have women function as aidim. It's a gezeirah sakasav, that's what the pasuk says. But when it comes to needing just one aid to clarify the facts, so then you certainly can have a woman do it, because the restriction on a woman functions as aidim is not because we don't believe that they're telling the truth. That's not the point at all. So when we need just to know the truth, so any one single person giving testimony, even a woman, is just perfectly fine. The one other area which we explored a bit in Maseches Yevamos at the end there, you'll recall, is that if we need to clarify if a woman's husband has died, which would allow her to marry again, so then we need to know the facts, and we will rely on the testimony of a single person to say, yes, I can confirm that the widow's husband died, and that one person, since it's just one person, could be a woman as well as a man, equally. Okay, so those are when aid echad comes. Now, to be acceptable as an aid, first of all, you cannot be a relative of either of the litigants. That's step number one. That's called a karov, and that's prohibited. In addition, the aid has to be someone who we can trust is who we can trust. And the Torah says someone who is a rasha, a wicked person, can't serve as an aid. So the basic definition of a rasha is someone who bemazed, intentionally violates isurim from the Torah, that are lavin from the Torah, you know, that carry the malchus, etc., carry lashes and the like. And also, if a person is a thief, known to be a thief, other kinds of you know moral turpitude, financial crimes, cannot be used as an aid. in addition, midrabbanan, if someone is like a, I'll call it a thief light. So we'll discuss what that means exactly. But things like, you know, I don't know, gamblers and people who sort of are technically midoraisa, not committing theft because of some technicality, but in the spirit they're doing some isra derabbanan, which is like, you know, looks and feels a lot like stealing. If it isn't exactly for whatever technical reason, those persons are also rabbinically prohibited from serving as edim, as witnesses. Okay. Now, what happens is that to establish the halachic fact, there's a requirement for the judges to extract testimony from the witnesses, the edim, and to sort of do what's called drish and chakira, to really sort of investigate, to press them for information. So there's a pasuk there that says, "Vidarasha v'chakarta v'sha'alta heitev." You'll really seek out and investigate and ask them well. Basically, the set of questions, the sets of questions that the judges are going to ask the witnesses to clarify the matter really kind of fall into two categories. One category is called chakiros, and chakiros basically boils down to just establishing the time and place of the alleged event. And the second category is bedikos, to sort of investigate other facts around the situation. So now, when the judges are functioning in this, you know, in the court case, understand that it's a function as a tribunal. You have these three judges, and they're the judge, so to speak, and the jury. There's no such thing as a jury as a separate, you know, panel in the Jewish Beis Din. The judges are functioning alone and making decisions. They're hearing the case. They're going to carry out the punishment. They're going to interpret the law. They're doing everything. So the judges are going to basically take one witness at a time and inquire first, doing the questions of the chakiros, to establish exactly when the witness claims exactly when and where the event took place. If the witness can't answer those questions precisely, so then their testimony is rejected out of hand. It has to be that they give testimony, which can be impugned by someone else saying, no, at that time or in that place, you were with us, not there. So then you can't be giving a testimony. That's called hazama. We'll talk about hazama in a moment. But the point is, if you can't answer the chakiros, then game over. Whereas the bedikos, the judges are asking other questions. So then, according to Rashi, if the witnesses can't answer these questions, the judges don't have to reject their testimony out of hand. According to the Rambam, there are certain, you know, the certain basic facts about the alleged crime, if that's what's happening, need to be answered, like the fact that the crime occurred and the like, or else, of course, the judges can dismiss the testimony as well. Okay, so the judges are basically going to do these bedikos, clarifying what happened according to each of the two witnesses, and if the two witnesses' testimonies corroborate, you know, one or the other, they say the same thing, so then that will be the establishing of the halachic fact for the Beis Din. Now, there is one important exception to this basic principle, which is that there's a takana derabbanan, this rabbinic enactment, which says that if you're discussing a case that involves hodos v'halvos, basically loans between people, so, and we want to establish if Reuven owes Shimon money or not, from a money that he, you know, said he'd pay him or didn't pay him, or to borrow from him and the like, so then we do not require this formal drish and chakira process of the edim, as long as witnesses can testify there was a loan that took place, and you know, to the best of knowledge, it wasn't repaid and the like, whatever, then that will be sufficient. So that's really a much lower standard than normally required. Usually we'd have to make the witness would have to say exactly when and where the loan took place, what day, what time. You know, if they can't remember, midoraisa, that should be no good. But midorabbanan, we're going to accept such testimony. The reason why is because it's a takana derabbanan. We are concerned, shlotinol delas b'fnei lovim. We don't want to lock the door, literally lock the door in front of borrowers, meaning since lending money in the Torah system is a kindness to needy people, if lenders say, listen, it'll be hard to collect my money because I have to get witnesses to remember details, you know, years later, I'll never get my money back, they won't lend, and that means we won't have money being lent for free, which we don't want that to happen, we want money to be loaned, and therefore we make it easier to collect on a loan, so that people won't be inhibited from lending. So that's that. Now, what do you do if you have conflicting testimony? I mean, let's say, for example, you have sets of witnesses that say something happened and sets of witnesses who say, no, that's not what happened. So, like I said before, we learned from the pasuk that if you have two witnesses, that's as good as 100. Okay, the principle is that tre kameya, two witnesses, has the same legal weight as 100 witnesses. What do you do if they disagree on what happened? So there are two kinds of conflict between witnesses. And one's called hakhasha and one's called hazama. Okay? Hakhasha is a basic conflict within the testimony. So in other words, two witnesses, one group of witnesses say, you know, Reuven killed Shimon, and another group of witnesses say, no, he didn't. Okay, so we're sort of stuck. If the two sets of witnesses' testimony are contradictory and can't be reconciled, so the Bezin remains in the Suffolk, we just don't know what to do, and therefore the Bezin will follow the rules of Suffolk. Okay, we won't carry things further. We're sort of at a between the, you know, immutable force, immovable object. There's two halachic certainties of two sets of testimony, but they don't add up. So we're stuck. We don't know what to do. So the Bezin is stuck in a Suffolk uncertain situation, and the rules of Suffolk will carry out. There's a second kind of conflicting testimony, which is a very specific situation, which is called Hazama. Hazama is that group A of witnesses testify, you know, that Reuven killed Shimon, or whatever it is, not about murder, anything. And then in that process, there's the Chakira, right? So the witnesses say that the event in question happened at a certain time, at a certain place. Now, if two other witnesses or more come up and they say, listen, we're not testifying necessarily about what actually happened because we don't know. So in other words, it's not hakash, we're not giving contradictory testimony. We're saying, you two witnesses who claim to have witnessed the event at such a time and such a place are definitely lying because you're with us at that time in a different place. That's a very specific situation. In other words, the second group is not testifying about the events of the case. They're simply testifying directly against the witnesses themselves, and the witnesses can't be telling the truth because they weren't present at the location at the time they said they were, because they were in another location with us. So there's a gezeiras hakasav that says that we believe the second pair of witnesses who are impugning the first set, and therefore we believe that the first set wasn't there, wasn't present, and then they get knocked out the water. That's called hazama. Okay, so the lying witnesses are called the edim zomimin, conspiring witnesses. Okay, now if it happens that the Bezdin ruled on the basis of the first set of witnesses, they didn't have the second set yet, and they ruled so-and-so is guilty, and they were going to, you know, carry out some punishment, whatever it is, or, you know, penalty, or whatever it is, against the accused, and then, prior to that happening, new witnesses come, and they say, no, 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 they impugn the first set, they mazim them, there's hazama that happens, so then, the pasuk says, va'asisim lo kasher zamam la'sos la'achiv, you do to them, the conspiring witnesses who were lying, what they attempted, what they conspired to do to their fellow Jew. So that means that if the conspiracy, the conspiring witnesses were lying about a $100 loan that was made, and then two witnesses come and say, no, they're liars, so then, of course, Reuven won't give the $100, the Q's won't pay $100. Instead, the two witnesses, between the two of them, will pay $100, meaning 50 each to their would-be victim, you know, the person who's accused of owing the 100. Okay, so actually a topic that comes up in the beginning of Maseches Makos, which I said before actually was originally part of Maseches Sanhedrin. Okay, that's the topic of Edom Zomim. Okay, now finally, the Bezdin, what is it in terms of, besides for making people make financial remuneration that people cause loss or damage or stole or whatever, the Bezdin also has various penalties that it can enforce. The first are Knossos. I mentioned that before. So the Knossos, we need to have Zainahur Musmachim, and we will, for all these kinds of onshin, all the kinds of punishments that the Bezdin enforces, they all require Musmachim, a Dainum that have smicha, which of course doesn't exist today, so this isn't all applicable, Bezman Hazeh, really. Nevertheless, the Torah is conceiving a world where people have smicha, and therefore a Bezdin can enforce things like the double payments for theft, the four or five payments for theft and sale or slaughter of goats and sheep and cows and the like, and other kinds of things. And there's rules. Knossos have their own set of rules. There's a rule of motive, but Knoss Pater and the like. So things Knossos work out themselves. That's financial penalties. Then, for most crimes that are prohibited by the Torah, generic lavin, so the Torah says you can't eat, you know, pork. If two witnesses come and say Reuven ate pork and they confirm that's the fact, so then they would punish Reuven with malchus. Now, malchus means lashes. To be eligible to be punished by lashes or any other punishments in the Torah, there needs to be not just witnesses, but what's called hasra'ah. Hasra'ah or hatra'ah. Hasra'ah is a warning. And this is very important because to be liable to lashes, well, we need to have acted b'mezid, intentionally. He had to know someone was forbidden, and he did it willingly, knowingly, knowledgeably, knowingly that what he's doing is against the Torah. So how could the Beis Din ever ascertain that he was willful and intentional and knew what was happening? We don't know what's going on inside somebody's head. So it has to be that there are witnesses who are watching and the perpetrator is told, you can't eat that cheeseburger, the Torah prohibits it, and if you do eat it, they're going to give you malchus for eating treif. And not only do they have to give that formal warning about the consequences of his actions in front of the witnesses, but also the perpetrator has to acknowledge the warning and say, afal pikein. He says, I know and I don't care, I'm doing it anyways. So he has to acknowledge the warning and say, I'm prepared to take the punishment, I don't care, I'm doing it. At that point, we know he was acting bemazed. So in such a scenario, if he then promptly, after acknowledging the warning, goes out and does the prohibition, at that point he's liable to the punishment. So you can see, or to actually be liable for punishment under Torah law is very difficult. And almost a person has to basically be asking for it. Okay, but be that as it may, if a person does a generic love from the Torah and does it amazed with Adam and Hasra, witnesses who warn him, then he'll get Malchus. Malchus, lashes from the Torah, is basically being whipped with a leather strap, from an eagle, like a calf, and it actually entails 39 separate lashes. It's called Malchus Arbaim, 40 lashes, but actually it's 40 minus 1, because 40 is thought to be like the, where he could kill a person, so the idea is that 39 is just the brink of death, if you will, and in fact, if the Beis Din ascertains that this person is not going to be able to survive all 39, they would cut it short, or they would give fewer than 39 lashes. Okay, there is a that none of this applies today because we don't have musmachim. There is a separate issue which is called makas mardus. So malkot with a lamed is like loket, to strike. That's the doraisa. But makat or makos mardus are like being hit for rebellion. That's for basically the court imposed, and it's basically for rabbinic violations, like you basically flouting the court or flouting the derabbanans, and though that is not necessarily with the leather strap, not necessarily 39, the court can do kind of what it sees fit, as it sees fit to enforce with corporal punishment, people who essentially are behaving badly, and the courts actually have a fair amount of latitude with that. If they see people are behaving, you know, very badly, they can bring them back into line with actual corporal punishment, the punishment to their bodies with, you know, lashing or beating and the like. Okay. Finally, you have the most severe of the penalties in the Torah, which is called Misas Beis Din, execution at the hand of the courts. This is a very rare, infrequent phenomenon. The Mishnah in Makos says any Sanhedrin does this, you know, once every 7 years. Another opinion says every 70 years. Another time say that would never happen ever under my watch. So the point is, those a court that even once every 7 years carries out a death penalty, it's called a chovlanis. It's like a destructive court, because really it's supposed to be nearly impossible to be liable to the death penalty unless really, like I said, you're asking for it. Be that as it may, the Torah does prescribe the death penalty for the most egregious of the crimes. The basic are the crimes like idol worship, murder, adultery, and other kinds of some of the other ariases, even Machal Shabbos, and other kinds of kishif, you know, like occult practices. Some of the most severe of the Torah crimes, they do carry with them a death penalty potentially. There are four misos Beis Din. There are four different ways that are prescribed depending on each mitzvah has their own specific misa. The first is called skila. Skila is literally stoning, and that means that the perpetrator is brought up to like a second story of a building and he's pushed off of the building and then hits the ground. If he survives the fall, then like a large rock is dropped on him. That's pretty nightmarish. And if he still survives that he's pelted with rocks until he dies. So that's skila, nightmarish. Then you have sreifa. Sreifa, it literally means burning, but we're talking here about basically molten lead or molten tin being poured down a person's throat, killing them instantly. Also horrible. Hereg. Hereg is which means killing. This is decapitation with a sword. It's called saif sometimes. A saif is a sword. So it's sort of, again, immediate death, decapitation. And then finally, chenek. Chenek means strangulation. This, they basically take like a silk rope, almost like a sash around the person's neck and pull from both sides and strangle them. All four of these, of course, are nightmarish. And they were essentially meant to avoid them at all costs. The pasuk says, "V'hatzilo ha'eda." You make an effort to save these people from such consequences. So the bezin is really, and there's a whole set of rules, which we'll see, Be'ez Hashem, to sort of avert this eventuality of Mises Bezin carrying out execution by the courts. So while it's a theoretical possibility, it should be very, very difficult under normal circumstances. Those people are really just wanton and terrible. Fine. So that's those are the four ways the court carries their punishment, and that really becomes that's the introduction to the whole Masechta. Wrapping up, I just want to say the structure of the Masechta, of Masechta Sanhedrin. There really are six separate sections. The first section is chapter 1, which talks about judges, how to choose judges, and how many judges you need for different kinds of cases. Then chapter 2, which is the second section, talks about the kind of special case of judgment, like, for example, a king or Kohen Gadol. Then the third section is chapter 3. It talks about the process of establishing a court and how Eidos works, how to collect Eidos and the like. Chapters 4, 5, and 6 discuss the procedure for capital cases, potential murder, potential execution cases. Chapters 6, the first half of 6, and the second half of 6 starts, and then 7, 8, and 9, as well as chapter 11, talks about the execution itself, the Mises Bezin, how that's carried out, the different procedures. And then finally, in our Mishnah, as we have it, the structure is chapter 10, and the Bavli, it's chapter 11, is the famous Perek Chelek, which talks about how a person could lose his portion in the world to come. So that becomes a little more like about Hashkafa, and in the Bavli itself, in the Gemara, it's like, tens of pages of Agadata, famous Gemaras. The Mishnayos, of course, are much more concise. So that is really the scope of our Masechta. So now, Be'ez Hashem, we will begin in earnest with Masechta Sanhedrin.